This is Farms Food Future, a podcast that's good for you, good for the planet, and good for farmers. Brought to you by the International Fund for Agricultural Development. I'm Brian Thompson.
And co-presenting this edition, I'm Michelle Tang.
Happy World Biodiversity Day. Today, we have a buzzing question for you.
Did you know that bees pollinate nearly 75% of our crops worldwide?
Astonishing, isn't it? These tiny creatures play an enormous role in our food systems.
Absolutely. But sadly, their survival is under threat due to intensive agriculture and pesticide use.
In episode 60, we speak to Justin Pals from the Keystone Foundation about protecting these vital pollinators through practices that support wild habitats. One approach gaining traction is integrating trees into farming.
That's right. For over 25 years, the Green Belt movement has championed agroforestry, not only to combat deforestation, but also to enhance soil health, promote biodiversity, and combat climate change by sequestering carbon dioxide. Led by the vision of Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai, they've pioneered a grassroots approach to reforestation, planting millions of trees across Kenya while engaging women in their communities.
Joining us to shed more light on this initiative is the chairperson of the board of directors, Nyaguthi Chege. We'll also be exploring how sustainable land use and agroecology benefit our ecosystems while combating malnutrition with young farmer Chengeto Mutsira from La Via Campesina.
And finally, we dive into ocean conservation with Gabby Amadia, Vice President of Area-Based Conservation for the Oceans Program at WWF US. We'll be talking about the consequences of trawling, a fishing method that indiscriminately captures marine life and damages the seabed.
Don't forget, we want to hear from you, what you think about our stories, and who you want us to be talking to. So please get in touch with us at podcasts@ifad.org. You can also subscribe to this podcast via your favorite podcast platform. And please don't forget to rate us.
Coming up, we speak to Justin Pals from the Keystone Foundation on traditional honey harvesting in India.
This is Farms Food Future with me, Brian Thompson, and Michelle Tang. In the Tamil language, Nilgiri is the union of the words blue and mountains. Established in 1986, the Nilgiri Biosphere Reserve in southwestern India, with its 2,000-meter peaks, is enveloped in a distinctive blue haze.
It stands as India's largest protected forest area, teeming with biodiversity and home to tribal communities like the Arula, Kurumba, and Toda. Wild honey production is where tradition meets environmental preservation in these unique forest ecosystems.
The Bacca skilled honey gatherers see it as a culturally significant activity shaping niches for wildlife. The Orang Rimba engage in sacred honey harvesting with specific rituals and respectful extraction from sealang trees.
Justin Pals, CEO of Ad Himalai, works with the Keystone Foundation balancing tradition, preservation and sustainable development in the Nilgiris. He's joined by young indigenous Toda Montish, who's been involved in the project. Our reporter, Rosa Gonzalez, spoke to them about youth involvement in the project.
So we are from the Nilgiris Biosphere Reserve, and we are from Keystone Foundation, which is an NGO operating in the Biosphere Reserve, and they are working on the upliftment of the livelihoods of the indigenous communities. So basically we've got Irula, Kurumba, Toda communities with whom we work with, and they are basically NTFP gatherers, non-timber forest produce gatherers, and then they work on a agroforestry model. So they work on honey collection, and then NTFP is like Shikakai, buy, you know, soap nuts, haritaki and those kind of products. And then they also work a lot on agriculture, like coffee, you know, millets, spices and things like that. So the youngsters, they're also working on the same thing. But for your question on how the impact is going on, so the traditional methods of honey collection, for example, is being communicated to the youngsters, but due to modernization and things, it is going on a very, very slow pace. So I think that is where the tradition and the culture is also getting lost a bit. So that's where we are trying to fill the gaps by archiving all those things. And then we are trying to give the youngsters the capacity building trainings on how to include the traditional methods. Through modern technologies, we are trying to take it back to the next generation so that it keeps continuing in the future as well.
What are these traditional methods that you're rescuing?
So, for example, honey collection is done by a team of 5 to 7 members who go inside the forest and they stay there for almost a week. And then they collect honey through traditional methods. They don't use modern technology. They don't use a ladder and all because it's not feasible in the forest. So they know which plants to cut down so that they can generate the smoke to shoo away the bees for some time so that they can collect the honey and afterwards the bees come back. So these kind of knowledge has to be transmitted to the youngsters now. So that is getting lost in between. And the creepers that they use as a ladder. So that kind of knowledge is what we want to take it to the youngsters. That is one thing. And then the other thing is something called sustainable harvesting. So if there is a honeycomb, they don't have to scrape off the whole honeycomb. Only the upper part has honey. The rest of the part doesn't have honey, so you don't have to scrape it off. So if you collect only the top part, the whatever bees go back, when they come back, the home is still there. And then it paves the way for colonization so that the reproduction of bees also happens. So these kind of knowledges is something that we want to take it to the communities. We are working inside the forest, so sometimes we have problems with the government officials, and then there are many people trying to build buildings inside and all. So during that time we have a lot of conflicts there, and then we also have a lot of wildlife conflicts happening because now the wild animals have started coming inside the villages. So that was not happening before 10 to 15 years. But since there's a lot of population increase and modernization, the animals are losing their spots, so they are starting to come inside the villages. So that is in one way affecting our livelihood there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're one of the young people that's working with them, no?
My name is Montish. I'm from South India and I belong to Toda community. So I think recently the youngsters got not interest in the traditional knowledge. They are out of the city. They are going to study for education. So now recently, from last 2 years, the youngsters start to understand and learn the traditional knowledge, about the traditional knowledge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how did you find out about it?
During the lockdown. So before that, they are far from the town. And after the lockdown, they all came together to the village and we did traditional farming and honey hunting during the lockdown times. We had no work during the pandemic time, no? So we did something like that in the traditional, I think.
So it grew during lockdown, the project?
Yes.
So he's from a community which has only 2,000 members there in the whole world. It's just 2,000 people from the Toda community. So they are main form of livelihoods raising buffaloes. But since the grasslands have decreased, they're not able to take the buffaloes for grazing. So the number of buffaloes has come down. So that has made them look for jobs outside to the town. So which is also bringing down their cultural practices, because once you go to the town, you'll be working on something else. Right, yeah. So because in the town you'll have to go for corporate jobs, something like that. So what happens is as the days go by, you forget what you've been doing. So your tradition, your culture goes down as well.
So this is also boosting their economy.
Yes, of course. So the grasslands are going down because we are from a hill station. It's a tourist area. Many buildings have been constructed there. So that's something that has been happening. And climate change is also playing a very big role. And that is also affecting their NTFP collection, their harvest. They're not able to predict the harvest properly. So they're not able to plan it properly. So those are all some problems why youngsters are deviating to another work.
Yeah. How is the community adapting to that? What are they doing?
So they are trying to stick to their traditional practices, but I think that is not generating more revenue for the families. So they will have to work side by side to uphold the traditional practices and to generate revenues as well. So they're juggling between the two, but I think there's a lot of effort to be put in so that we can promote the communities again.
Thanks to Justin and Montish. For more on bee security, you can check out episode 43 of this podcast. Here we spoke to founder and chief executive of Macedonian Honey, Elena Fidanoska, about innovative technology to protect, strengthen, and heal honeybees. Up next, we speak to Miyaguti Chege from the Green Belt Movement in Kenya.
You're listening to episode 60 of Farms Food Future with me, Michelle Tang, and Brian Thompson. The Green Belt Movement was founded by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Wangari Maathai in Kenya in 1977, while she was working at the University of Nairobi and volunteering at the National Council of Women of Kenya, or NCWK. Green Belt started as a NCWK project to support rural women, small-scale farmers, to address the needs they had identified on their farms.
Such as reduced harvests, poorer crop quality, increased soil erosion, having to walk further and further to fetch water and firewood. So together, the women decided that the answer was to plant trees on their farms because this would protect the soil and result in better nutrition for their families from the fruit and nuts.
Over time, the key focus shifted to planting predominantly in highland areas that serve as natural reservoirs for water, with 70% of tree seedlings allocated to water catchments and the remaining 30% distributed to communities for on-farm planting. Neguthi Chege serves as the chairperson of the board of directors of the Green Belt Movement.
She spoke to our reporter, Rosa Gonzalez, about their efforts to combat deforestation, soil erosion, and promote biodiversity, while also providing socio-economic benefits to local communities.
Hello, Nyagudi, and thank you for joining us today on the podcast. So to give our listeners a bit of context about the Green Belt Movement, could you share with us a memorable story or experience that illustrates your work with local communities and the environment?
Absolutely. We have a great example from really recent times. Late last year in 2023, we were hosting visitors from France in Dundori Forest in Nakuru, which is in the Mau Forest, a catchment area, one of Kenya's five key catchment areas, and an area that the Green Belt Movement has been working in, helping to restore and rehabilitate the forest for several years. And on that visit, we came across women who were fetching water in a river that originates from the Dundori Forest. And the women, you know, just in their normal day-to-day conversation, were discussing how water availability in the stream over the years has increased due to the conservation efforts. And one of the women said, and I'll say this in Swahili and do a translation for you, she said, "Kama sio kupanda hizi miti, hii mto ingekuwa bado imekauka," which means if we hadn't planted these trees, the river would have continued to have stayed dry just as it was before. And it's clear that even for these women, these rural women, the conservation efforts that together with the Green Belt Movement have taken on has translated into water availability for the local communities that's flowing through the streams and rivers from the forest and is immediately available for them. And they can see this outcome right now, not this long-term benefit that will be coming far into the future.
So how are you helping small-scale farmers with better nutrition, healthier soil, water conservation, and increased productivity? Also, how do these efforts help protect wildlife and restore the environment?
Yeah, so we see that, you know, for example, this example we've just given you about the Dundori Forest, where we see an immediate improvement, the rehabilitation of the forests. We see an immediate improvement in the health of the ecosystem of the forest. And a healthier ecosystem is important not just for us as humans, but also for the fauna and flora as well. Working with the local communities, especially those living adjacent to the forest, we also support them in the field of climate smart agriculture, where households promote agricultural practices that are climate friendly and resilient. But it's important to note here that not only are we talking about new and improved methods and methodologies. We also rely on the community's traditional knowledge and cultural practices and make sure that these are supported as well, not just in terms of the ways that they farm, but also in what they are planting and the agriculture they are producing. And also, finally, we support and embrace different methods of water harvesting, because this is really key. You know, a significant portion of our lands in Kenya is actually semi-arid and arid, and the threat of the encroachment of arid lands is real in a large part of Kenya. So depending on the environment, on the ecosystem, and also the different needs of the household, we also support different methods of water harvesting, which allows these families to produce on their lands practically year-round. And this helps protect the forest so that farmers are not constantly going into the forest in order to harvest, at least in ways that are protective of the forest and not in ways that are damaging, such as reducing the cutting of trees for timber and for firewood. And this protection of these forest ecosystems really helps to protect the biodiversity that we see. In addition, these forests also serve as a very key absorber of carbon. These forests provide part of the mitigation solution for our global crisis.
And looking ahead, what are your key priorities in the coming years? And how do you envision the organization's role in addressing the pressing global environmental challenges?
Most of our work is focused on protecting our water towers, the key five water catchment forests in Kenya. The communities that live adjacent to this forest include a lot of indigenous peoples as well. So the Greenbelt movement works with women's groups at the grassroots level, particularly in the tree seedling production and the tree nursery groups. These tree nursery groups produce quality indigenous tree seedlings. And of course, these are the ones that are naturally adapted and over, you know, hundreds and thousands of years have proven to be the ones that are best for the local community. We retain members of the community as green volunteers. And these are the ones who, for a period of 3 years, are the ones who are provided with an income in order to be the eyes and ears of the community, protecting these seedlings while they're in the initial phase. And after this period, we then officially hand over these sections of the forest back to Kenya Forestry Service, who then continue as custodians to ensure that these indigenous areas in the forest are protected for the long term. Now, this work, all of it, has a ripple effect on conservation, because once the living conditions and the livelihoods for the women and their families have improved, the threat on the natural forests and our natural resources decreases significantly, because as we said, the interests of the women and the families and the communities that are adjacent to the forest is tied in to the protection of the forest itself. The achievements that we have made in terms of environmental protection, and particularly in terms of the protection of our forests, we cannot take those for granted, because for us here in Kenya, and I'm sure in other places as well, the protection of our environment and the rights we fought for were not granted to us. They weren't gifted to us. They were really wins that we fought for hard, and sometimes through not just our sweat, but really through blood and tears as well. Professor Mathai said to us several years ago that the rights that we fought for are not there to be put on a shelf for us to look at and enjoy, but they must be protected and continuously protected all the time.
Thanks, Niaguthi. You can find out more at greenbeltmovement.org. Now, stay tuned as we speak to Chingeto Mutsira, representative of La Via Campesina's Youth Articulation in Africa.
This is Farms Food Future. I'm Michelle Tang, and I'm joined by Brian Thompson. La Via Campesina is an international movement that champions the rights of small-scale farmers, peasants, indigenous peoples, and rural workers. They're a powerful voice advocating for food sovereignty and address issues ranging from land tenure to the impacts of industrial agriculture and environmental degradation.
Today, we're joined by Chengeto Sandra Motsira, a young farmer from Mutoko, Zimbabwe, deeply engaged in agroecology and small grain production. As a member of La Via Campesina, she represents Africa on the organization's Youth International Coordination Committee. Chengeto spoke to our reporter, Rosa Gonzalez, about sustainable land practices within agroecology that boost biodiversity and support small-scale farmers.
Unlike conventional farming, agroecology emphasizes working with nature, promoting biodiversity, and respecting the autonomy of farmers and communities. By adopting agroecology practices, rural communities can enhance the resilience of their food systems in many ways. Agroecology encourages the cultivation of a diverse range of crops, which enhances dietary diversity and ensures a more balanced nutrition diet for local communities. Sustainable land use practices within agroecology prioritize soil health and include the conservation of water. This is crucial in regions facing water scarcity in ensuring that water is available for both the communities and the crops. The methods are aimed to minimize and eliminate the use of synthetic chemicals. This reduces the environmental impacts, prevents soil and water pollution, and also ensures that production is chemical-free. It brings a holistic approach and empowerment that enhances food sovereignty, that communities have control over their food system, over the pricing of their product, over the market, thus contributing to a healthier and a more sustainable food system.
Thank you. You've stressed sustainable land use's importance, and this brings us to the crucial need for farmers' access to land, a cause La Via Campesina champions. So how does your organization support farmers facing land insecurities?
So La Via Campesina supports smallholder farmers with land insecurity issues such as land grabbing. For the past 17 years, we've seen La Via Campesina campaigning for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other People Working in the Rural Areas. This declaration has been a tool for empowering peasants to defend their rights over the issues of land, over the issues of seed, over issues of water and forest. And the UNDROP also defends people's rights to oppose attempts to grabbing of land, grabbing of rivers and oceans. And it also recognizes the rights of peasants to conserve, use and exchange and sell traditional seeds, which is under threat at the moment because the law criminalizes farmers from doing this. And through La Via Campesina also, peasants around the world are organized through collectives. For example, when we look in our region, the Southern and Eastern Africa region, we collaborate with Africa Center for Biodiversity, and these help us in terms of understanding the seed laws, understanding the land laws that are in different countries. In the recent years, we have suffered from implementation of new policies and new development models based on land expansion and land exploitation, commonly known as land grabbing. And land grabbing has resulted in the concentration of ownership of land, natural resources in the hands of large-scale investors, plantation owners, hydropower and mining companies. This has led to the eviction and displacement of local population, and usually these are farmers, women and rural youth. Rural farmers, indigenous people are being displaced to pave way for transnational companies who come then to produce things like soybeans for exports. This compromising also the food systems within Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. And how does La Via Campesina tackle inequalities in land ownership and rights, especially those affecting indigenous communities, women and youth?
Women and youth are usually not involved in decision-making processes and in policy formulation or even project planning and implementation. This is where all the inequalities come from because they won't be involved in the planning and implementation of policies. To address women's particularly limited access to land issues due to discriminatory laws and policies and other practices, women should have equal and even priority treatment in terms of land and agrarian reform and settlements. If women are not involved, we understand that women are the ones who work in the fields. Women are the ones who, 70% of them work in agriculture. And all the impacts that comes with climate change affect women and youth. This is where we see the issues of migration, where young people, women are forced to migrate from their rural homes and go to towns for a better living. This is where we see a lot of unsocial activities happening, because if they can't produce enough from the land, they are then forced to engage in unsocial activities that then affect their health at the end of the day. We see women and youth being affected by high rates of unemployment, high rates of poverty. Their standard of living is reduced. There are a lot of conflicts, and these conflicts usually put women, children, and youth vulnerable.
Thank you. We'll be hearing more from La Via Campesina in future episodes, so keep an ear out. And for more information, you can check out their website, viacampesina.org.
Wrapping up, we talk coral reefs and trawling with Gabby Ahmadia, Vice President of Area-Based Conservation for the Oceans Program at WWF US. This is Farms Food Future. I'm Brian Thompson, and I'm joined by Michelle Tang. At WWF US, Gabby Ahmadia oversees science teams working on seascapes, fisheries, and blue forest issues.
She has produced over 60 scientific articles on ocean conservation, advocating for underrepresented voices to lead conservation solution efforts. She spoke to our reporter Kira Rainsby on the devastating effects of climate change on the ocean and rural coastal communities and the impact of trawling, a fishing method that involves a large net that captures everything in its path, including the seabed.
WWF actually works in a lot of different places across the world on coastal communities, but you do see the impacts of habitat degradation, biodiversity loss, even in these really remote places. You can see everything from impacts on people's health, on their nutrition, to impacts on just their safety. Two of the biggest things that communities are often dependent on for marine natural resources or food, which provides daily nutrition. A lot of fish actually provide a lot of critical nutrients that are really important for growth and development in people. But also, you know, they often sell these fish. And so if you start using a lot of these resources and coastal habitats aren't producing the same amount of fisheries, then it leads to a loss of income. And the other thing we see sometimes is the impacts on coastal protection. So for example, if mangrove forests are getting cut down in large swaths, it just doesn't provide the same protection from like big storms that come in and waves and flooding. And that, you know, obviously has an impact on human safety. We've seen a lot of this play out in Mozambique and Madagascar, where these coastal communities are just really exposed to impacts of increasing storms from climate change.
So all over the world, we've been seeing coral reefs dying and they're losing their color. So what does this mean in terms of climate change and in terms of being able to restore the natural habitat of many marine species?
Right, so we do see climate change impacting coral reefs around the world. Some places are definitely more vulnerable than others. In terms of climate change, they're heating up quicker. They're exposed to longer duration of these heating events or thermal events that are happening. And so this does make us think about conservation differently. We have to think about protecting some of these places we think are more climate resilient. I'm thinking about how we can protect the most critical habitats that are less prone to the impacts of climate change. And perhaps we get these critical habitats protected and they can serve as like nursery grounds or spawning habitats for replenishment of other habitats. And the other thing that we need to consider is when we do habitat protection and restoration, we actually have to think about climate smart species. So this means maybe if we're doing mangrove restoration, we need to think about the mangroves and the right species that can actually live and survive in a changing climate. Same for corals. There's a lot of really interesting research going into corals, and we need to think about replenishing habitats with those that are more climate resilient and can handle these future impacts of climate change.
We know that trawling is a phenomenon that greatly affects the development of marine biodiversity. I wanted to know first, how is it greatly affecting the development? And what does this mean in terms of ensuring food security worldwide?
So this is about getting the balance right. You know, we're never going to stop trawling altogether. I don't think that's very realistic. But I do think we can think about how we trawl and the equipment that's used and where we trawl. You know, and if we can get the better management under control of where least vulnerable habitats are, we shouldn't be putting trawls over really critical productive habitats, but thinking about where we can have the least impact. Same as different gear types. There's, you know, advances in gears for bottom trawling that have less impact on the environment. You know, I was exposed to a lot of this when I lived in the Gulf of Mexico, and you can see the impact of shrimp on the ecosystems there. And there was a lot of tension between shrimpers and traditional biodiversity conservationists, and how do you actually find that balance? Shrimp in the Gulf of Mexico provide shrimp to so many people across the world, you know, with increasing demands for seafood, which we know actually has, you know, less of a climate impact than a lot of other foods, and we will continue to see this demand. So we need to, you know, figure out the best way to ensure that we can continue this industry while minimizing impacts on the environment.
And finally, what is the most sustainable solution to protecting the oceans and marine life from climate change, taking into account the need to provide food security for also human communities?
There's no one answer to this. This is a collective set of solutions that need to address these problems. And when we're able to address collectively some of the biggest drivers of what's causing loss of biodiversity, but this takes engagement from the financial sector, from businesses, from conservation organizations, governments. There's individual action that can take to help further, you know, biodiversity wins. And but again, there's not one solution. I think people want one solution, but unfortunately, conservation's messy. We're operating in political environments, and you know, there's people, you know, in these places, and so all of those need to be considered when we're working on developing out conservation strategies and programs.
Thank you, Gabby. And that brings us to the end of episode 60. Thanks, as always, to our producer here in Rome, Francesco Manetti, and to our reporters Rosa Gonzalez and Kira Rainsby. But most of all, thanks to you for celebrating World Biodiversity Day by listening to episode 60 of Farms Food Future, brought to you by the International Fund for Agricultural Development. You can find out more about any of these stories at www.ifad.org/podcasts.
Next month, diversity is the star of the show. Join us in just 2 weeks as we bring you stories from the front lines of change, featuring disability and gender champions like Malawian farmer Emily Simika.
And the last week of June, we embrace the spirit of Pride Month as we come out with our special LGBTQ plus episode number 62. Remember, we want to hear from you, what you think about our stories and who you want us to be talking to. So please get in touch at podcasts@ifad.org.
Send us your voice or text messages to this address, and we'll be happy to play you out in the next show. Also, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via your favorite podcast platform, and please rate us.
And once again, we'll be trying to be good for you, good for the planet, and good for the farmers. Until then, from me, Brian Thompson, and the team here at IFAD,
thanks for listening.